Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Days may seem like a passing phase, but for Brooke Reinhart, it was the amount of time when her beautiful life, marriage, new house, and plans to start a family, all came to a complete stop. Anna Chlumsky stars in the hit HBO comedy Veep, now in its final season. She reads us Brooke's essay, Sharing the Shame After My Arrest.
We had been married for just over a year when the FBI showed up at our house at 6 a.m. and arrested me. They arrested my husband, too, although at the time that seemed beside the point. A stickler for rules who had never even gotten a speeding ticket, I was handcuffed in my mismatched pajamas and hauled away. My teeth weren't even brushed. The charges against me, against us both, were wire fraud and conspiracy to commit mail fraud. In a state of shock, I began babbling to the FBI agents that I would never open mail that wasn't addressed to me. Never, ever. If only it were that simple. When the indictment was unsealed, I learned that my dear husband had, in the simplest terms, used my identity to embezzle tens of thousands of dollars from his workplace, among other crimes. His using my identity made it look as if I was involved. I wasn't. I appeared in a federal courtroom to plead not guilty. A newspaper photographer chased me down the street, trying to get a picture of my face. I handed over my passport to the court. I took drug tests, a process that almost made me laugh. What would show up, my Claritin? I was assigned a probation officer that I had to see every week. I took more drug tests. I wasn't allowed to leave the state unless the court approved. I died inside, day by day. I vacated the beautiful house my husband and I had bought 8 months earlier, leaving my clothes and the new kitchen gadgets for my bridal shower, leaving the new neighborhood where I had begun to make friends, and leaving my husband. And I moved home. A 28-year-old going back to my parents' house while my personal life was plastered across the news. Everyone saying I had conspired to commit crimes. At first, my husband tried to communicate with me, tried to apologize, but my lawyer contended it was unwise to be in touch given the charges. So my contact with my husband, my love of 5 years, ceased completely. The federal charges were held against me for 90 days. That might not sound like a long time when discussing, say, party plans. But when facing criminal charges, losing your home and leaving the man you loved, or thought you loved, because after all, who was he really? Without so much as a word of goodbye. When that's your life, 90 days is an eternity. I decided to sleep on the couch at my parents' house. I was unable to go into my bedroom, where I had played with dolls, learned to paint my nails, and held slumber parties. It seemed like a sign of true regression and failure to sleep in my childhood bed at 28. So I slept on the couch.
Introducing Magic Jack, the breakthrough device that makes your monthly phone bills disappear.
The couch was perpendicular to the TV, so I could lie down and watch mindless programming all night. It was parallel to the matching love seat. A furniture set covered in stiff, green, outdated fabric. I slept on that couch for 90 nights, the full period I faced federal charges. And for those 90 nights, my mother slept on the love seat, her limbs hanging off at odd angles. I didn't ask her to sleep there. She just did. We have so many beds in this house, my father said. Why isn't anyone using them? Because Brooke can't, my mother answered. My mother mostly stopped eating. My father tried to encourage us to take a few bites at each meal. We can't, my mother said. My days were spent in a dark haze. I fantasized about accidental death. While driving, I would think, how fast would I need to go to miss the turn and hit a tree? While walking upstairs, I would think, what if I were to trip and fall backwards? Might I hit my head and never wake up? I could barely see my mother during the night, even with the light from the TV, though she was only 10 feet away. Occasionally, I could hear her breathing or her movements as she adjusted an arm or a leg in her cramped quarters. I'd stare in her direction, wondering if she was staring back. I didn't sleep for more than 30 minutes at a time, my heart pounding. Are you okay? She'd whisper. Are you okay? I'd whisper back. It was our code. There was no real answer, but asking the question was enough. And the answer, the repeated question, at least meant that we were alive. During those nights, we learned about infomercial inventions, from Snuggies to Magic Jacks, and discussed their merits and pitfalls each morning. A blanket with sleeves? I said. Have you ever thought you were so cold you couldn't move your arm out from under your blanket to grab your coffee? The buzz of the television filled our nights. You okay? Are you okay? At her lowest point, my mother spent a full day on the laundry room floor, slumped against the washing machine, unable to move. The severity of my situation had consumed her. Her heart had broken so severely that her body and mind broke too. I knew she needed help. So did I. I wasn't ready for help, though. I anticipated that someday, when this was over, my weeks would be filled with therapists and doctors, all trying to make me whole again. But not yet. So I helped my mother look up psychiatrists on her insurance plan. We drove 30 miles to her first and only appointment. I waited outside. On the way home, she recounted how the psychiatrist had asked her to make goals. Her main goal, my mother said, was to stop making this about her. She felt guilty that her grief was somehow stealing the show. But my mother's making this about her was actually saving me. To know that someone loved me so much, was willing to feel my pain so intensely that it kept her on the laundry room floor for a day, made me feel encased in a bubble of protection. I began to wonder if sadness was this finite thing, a big black mass of which there was only so much in the world. If so, my mother was sharing it with me so that I did not have to bear the full weight. The more she took, the more she was unable to eat and sleep, and the faster her heart raced, the less of it there was for me. It wasn't just my mother who came to my rescue during those months, and the many months after I navigated a painful divorce, sold my new house, lost many possessions and much of my money. It was my father, too, who made sure I kept moving forward and didn't give up. It was my friend from high school and her husband who dubbed their home the halfway house, a place where I was welcome at any time. It was my college roommate who flew from St. Louis to help me clean my house so I could sell it, and her sorority sister in Canada who sent me a dozen emails every day to keep my mind occupied. It was many of the people in the small town where I grew up who sent endless cards, flowers, and food, each trying to show love and support. Until, after 90 days, the charges against me were dropped. My husband pleaded guilty and was sentenced to prison. few months later, I had a routine OBGYN checkup. My doctor came into the room, glancing at my file. I hadn't seen her for more than a year. When I was arrested, it had saturated local news coverage. Everyone knew, or so it seemed to me, and I grew accustomed to averting my eyes, to feeling that familiar shame and humiliation whenever I went out in public. But somehow my doctor had missed the news. Seeing her friendly expression, I could tell she had no idea. "Hi, Brooke," she said, smiling. "So, when you were here last year, you said you might want to try to get pregnant around this time." I went numb. She was right. I had been here in my newlywed bliss talking about babies and prenatal vitamins. I stared at her. "Something bad happened to me," I said, unsure of how to begin. But then it all came out. My arrest, my husband's deceit, the charges, the end of my marriage, the loss of my house, the whole harrowing ordeal. When I finished, her eyes were wet. "How have you survived this?" she asked. I thought for a second. While the charges were held against me, I slept on the couch in my parents' house. I spent 90 days on that couch. And my mom? She slept for 90 nights on the love seat. My doctor blinked, unable to hold back her tears. "What a mom," she said softly. "What a mom."
Anna Klumsky, reading Brooke Reinhardt's essay, "Sharing the Shame After My Arrest." We'll hear from Brooke and her mom in a minute.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says Brooke Reinhardt's essay is one of those that really asks an important question.
What do we think is love? What is it really? And the love that really ends up rescuing her and sustaining her is her familial love and her mother and her father. And that is really the lifelong love for her.
Well, we talked to Brooke's mom, Jo, and Jo says she'll never forget when Brooke, half crying, half laughing, looked at her and said, "Mom, we don't have any practice at this." Jo says the family had lived a charmed life until then, so we asked her if she ever doubted her daughter's innocence.
"I know her. I knew she couldn't have done such a thing." And when we got to court on that morning, she was sitting at this big, long table, and it was heartbreaking. And she turned around and said, kind of mouthed, "I didn't do it." And I half chuckled to myself, like, well, I know that. I know you didn't do anything. Like, I just know it. I just knew it. So that was the beauty in this whole horrible situation, was having such faith and trust in your child.
But weeks later, with no clear end in sight, Jo began to unravel. She said she regretted her own despair and pulling attention away from Brooke. Then she read the Modern Love essay.
The story she wrote was such a love story to me, and I truly so greatly appreciate it. But it helped me understand that, and it got rid of a lot of my guilt, because I felt guilty. It was a terrible feeling as a mother. So then to read those lines, I thought, oh, maybe it did help her. She felt that I was carrying some of her pain, and maybe that did help.
That's Jo Reinhart, Brooke's mother. Next, we'll have an update from Brooke herself, and it's worth the wait.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Well, how is Brooke Reinhart doing today? She joined us via Skype from her garage in Denver.
So we're about 9 years later, and to say that I'm doing great would probably be an understatement. I'm doing better than fantastic. I reconnected with someone, a guy that I knew back in high school from my hometown, and ended up dating him long distance for a little bit. And he moved out here a couple years later. And we actually just welcomed our first son 5 days ago.
So now you know why Brooke had to duck into the garage to talk with us. Brooke says she never spoke to her ex-husband again and is firmly focused on the future. He, for the record, pleaded guilty to wire fraud charges and was sentenced to 15 months in prison. Looking back on her arrest, Brooke says the lessons she learned about a mother's unconditional love continue to resonate.
I do feel like I got a taste of what motherhood was from being able to see it from the other side, because I was able to see so strongly just how much a mom would do for her child. And now I'm able to feel that, having my own little one. And again, it's so new, but I would do anything for him. And I know I would in the future. And I can even, now that I see what he looks like, I can kind of fast forward and see what he looks like as a toddler and what he'll look like when he goes to college. And I certainly would sleep on the couch or do anything that this little guy needs from me.
Brooke Reinhart. She now lives in Colorado and works for a public relations agency in New York City. Thanks again to Anna Klumsky for reading this week's essay. Here's why she chose this piece.
This essay really just encompassed all of the ways that love can both kind of bewitch us and then save us. And I think that many of us as daughters throughout our lives, when we're not as downtrodden as this author was, I think sometimes it's harder for us to accept that kind of love from our parents. It just felt so pure.
Anna Klumsky. You can see her now in season 7 of the HBO comedy Veep. Next week, Lorraine Toussaint.
It's a dividing line as real as any in America. Those who grapple with race and those who do not. But like most dividing lines, it's impossible to tell on which side a person stands by looking at them. Or at least that's what I thought at the time.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Samantha Hennig, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week. I'm sorry.